I'm Lee Kuchevsky, and you're listening to the Merging Futures Podcast, where we sit in conversation with leading voices at the intersection of science, technology, and the arts. Today, we're sharing a conversation with leading scientist and community builder, Dr. Ellen Jorgensen. She joined me in the studio in New York in May of 2019 to discuss synthetic biology and community biohacking. And we began our conversation by me asking Dr. Jorgensen what initially sparked her interest in science. Let's hear what she has to say.
Johnny Quest. It was a cartoon in the 1960s when I was a kid. And it was a cartoon about a boy. His father was a scientist. His mother was conveniently absent. His other male role model was a bodyguard. So his father taught him science. The bodyguard taught him martial arts. And he had a best friend who was a kid who was from India who knew magic. And so between them, he had like the perfect childhood. And his father went all over the world being a famous scientist doing important work of some sort. And I don't know, there was just this whole feeling at that time that scientists were just very powerful figures. People looked up to them. They were very respectable. They were people that were trying to save the world. They were people that you wanted to be. And so I actually have somewhere a diary where I've written that, you know, at like 9 years old, that I have to become a scientist because of this.
Our guest today is Dr. Ellen Jorgensen. She's a PhD-trained molecular biologist who co-founded GenSpace, the world's first community biotech laboratory, and Biotech Without Borders, a nonprofit dedicated to democratizing the practice of biotechnology for useful and peaceful purposes in order to benefit humankind and the planet. Ellen's word gave me pause. She said, "People that you wanted to be." I can't imagine a better time for being a scientist than now, when the world is facing immense challenges in the face of a global epidemic. We all need to put our lens of the scientist on in order to see more clearly. Let's get a sense of what it means to build a community at the intersection of different disciplines. Most of the work that I'm interested in happens at these edges, right? It's like you bring an artist together with a scientist, with a technologist, and you see what happens in that. And I feel like a lot of the community hackerspaces, whether it's synthetic biology or it's just a traditional hackerspace where people are just making stuff with 3D printers and so on, I feel like that kind of environment is magical. Like something happens there. There's a spirit that comes out of that. Can you describe that feeling in your own lab?
I think it's kind of a mistake to think that the arts and the sciences are so far apart. It's really the value proposition that is different, but kind of the way that you work at high levels of both is very similar. So you have these stories about a chemist having a dream and discovering the structure of benzene and almost quasi-mystical things happening to scientists that result in advances. I think people are fascinated by the field that they're not in. So when I did this weird double major for the first 2 years at UMass, I was in a program where I could design my own major. And there was a point where you had to make this exhibition of what you'd done after the year was over. And the chemistry professors were all really impressed with theater and art, and they were all impressed with the chemistry. So it's this fascination that you have for the thing that you're not an expert in. And I think it's fun to get inspired by people that aren't doing the same thing that you're doing. One of the things that happened early on the trajectory of my first community lab, GenSpace, was we were looking for a physical space to rent, and we considered the biotech incubator at SUNY Downstate, which was a beautiful space. And it turned out it was just a little bit too expensive for us, and we would have had to share it with other people that all had to be ready to rent at the same time. So just logistically, it didn't work out. But I'm so glad it didn't, because we ended up on a floor in a building that's known for creatives, this 33 Flatbush. There's actually been a New York Times article about it. The man who owns it, Alatara, is very committed to having this environment where people can be creative, and it's full of nonprofits and artists and architects and musicians and writers and all sorts of different people, green technology companies, social entrepreneurs. And the floor that we went on to was makers. So you had to be a maker of some sort at that point. The floor had formed an organization. We later ended up calling it Dark Matter Manufacturing, or DAM. And it sort of fit our bill, because we were biomakers. And then there were other people that made all sorts of incredible interactive displays for things. Most of the people on the floor were graduates of the MIT Media Lab. And it was just nice to clear your mind, to kind of walk on the other side of the floor and see really strange robotic babies or other weird things happening. Giant screens that would mirror you and things like that. Actually, the membership of GenSpace in the beginning was pretty heavy on the bio art, because the artists kind of discovered us first. Our whole thing was sort of, we'll build it, but since we're the first in the world, we have no idea who's going to show up. And I was hoping that people who were entrepreneurial in the sciences would show up. But what we got at first was a lot of artists. And it was interesting to see how they interacted with the lab. I do have to say, though, what you're saying about this interface between people of different disciplines, that is absolutely true, that most of the advances come at that interface. But putting that interface together doesn't automatically mean you're going to get an advance.
The real breakthroughs that I tend to see in terms of people coming together and those boundaries touching at the edges, they usually happen when people do very deep work.
I think I would agree with that. Once in a while, you get people that come up with a good idea sort of over coffee or whatever. But it's usually the basis for that is usually having worked in a field for a long period of time very seriously,
right,
or thought about something very seriously.
Our guest today, Dr. Jorgensen, is someone who has thought very seriously about synthetic biology and citizen science. Ellen's TED Talks on the gene editing technology CRISPR and DIY biohacking have been collectively viewed nearly 3.5 million times. Most recently, her work was also featured in the Ken Burns documentary, The Gene, and she's been named by Fast Company as one of their most creative leaders in business. She shares with us her thoughts on synthetic biology and the gene editing technology called CRISPR, what it was like to be the first to teach the general public about CRISPR and its effects. Stay tuned.
Synthetic biology, there are a couple of real stretch goals for synthetic biology. One is to be able to understand the processes in the cell and all of the molecular pathways to the extent that you could create a virtual cell on a computer, and you could do an experiment and know how the piece of DNA that you put in is going to impact everything else. Right now, it's like loading a program onto a laptop where there's a million other programs running, and you get that annoying message that says that one program is interfering with another. If we could understand everything that was going on, the idea is that maybe we could design better and design things that wouldn't, like if we want a bacteria that eats an oil slick or something, we would be able to design it a lot faster and more efficiently if we could design it with full knowledge of all the other stuff that's going on in there. So prediction, predictive ability based on modeling is a huge thing in synthetic biology. That's one. The other thing is the idea of parallel biology. So you can create a completely artificial biological system, theoretically, if you change what it's based on. So science fiction sometimes talks about silicon-based life forms because, just in brief, the shape of the carbon atom is a tetrahedron and it makes it easy to build things with it. Silicon has a tetrahedral shape as well. So that's why, you know, you get science fiction where there's a silicon-based life form. But you can also imagine a lot of the molecules in biology have a handedness, sort of a left-handedness or a right-handedness, like the twist of the double helix goes in one direction, not the other. You can imagine a world where all of that is a mirror image, and then everything would work perfectly, except it would be unable to have anything to do with really our biology because none of the molecules would fit each other, basically. And so George Church has talked about this in his book Regenesis, about how you could make a completely mirrored organism or a system within an organism that wouldn't interfere with anything else. And you can also think of a lesser hack would be codes for the DNA that would be different, or letters in the DNA that would be different. So right now we have four letters, G, A, T, and C. And when they build proteins, which is what most of DNA encodes, is recipes for proteins, they're parsed in groups of three. And the reason is proteins have 16 amino acid building blocks. And if you've got four different letters, G, A, T, and C, obviously, if one letter corresponded to one amino acid, you wouldn't have enough. And two would be four times four, which is 16, which is still, we've got 20 amino acids and 16. Four times four is 16. But if you go four times four times four, now you have 64, and now you have plenty. Mm. So it's parsed in threes, but you can also build a system where it's parsed in fours. Or you can build a system where instead of G, A, T, and C, you also have X and Y. So, and chemists have done this. And some of the first systems have been actually put into living cells and been shown to work in sort of a parallel way. So there's a lot of really crazy stuff coming down the pike with biology.
What is the Cas9? What is the CRISPR?
CRISPR is an acronym that refers to something in the genome of the bacteria where CRISPR is found. And it really doesn't, the acronym doesn't have anything to do with the part of that system that we hijacked and now use as genome editing. So it's not so much that CRISPR and Cas9 are two different things. It's that the CRISPR system, which was an ancient bacterial sort of an immune system where bacteria could actually recognize something that infected them before. And by the way, bacteria get viruses too, just like us. They're called phages. And this was a system that we didn't even know existed until the early 2000s. We had no idea they could defend themselves like this and that they had any kind of memory, immune memory. And the solution that they do to get rid of invaders is they keep a small snippet of the invader's DNA as kind of a mugshot and create a molecule that has two components. Not a molecule, but a complex of molecules. One component recognizes that mugshot. It uses a very similar chemical cousin to DNA called RNA that will literally hybridize or bind to that specific place in the DNA. And the other half of it is an enzyme that cuts DNA. And so in the natural system, it sends this guided missile off so that it will destroy the invader the next time it sees it. In the way that we use it, we just take that protein and we make an artificial piece of RNA that guides this protein to wherever we want it. And then once that damage happens, our cells have this repair system where if we see the DNA strand, the double helix getting cut through both strands, it's a catastrophic event. And the body sends in these repair systems. And we have ways where we can kind of trick those into repairing it, not to look exactly the way it was before, but kind of the way we wanted it to. And, you know, you might say, well, what's the big deal? We've been genetically modifying organisms since the 1970s. The problem was before that, we couldn't make sure that the piece of DNA that we put in went in exactly in the genome where we wanted it to. It was kind of hit or miss. Some of the early gene therapies actually gave people cancer because they interrupted genes that were suppressing tumors. And people got leukemia and things like that. Now, what they actually did was they took something out of the AIDS playbook. The AIDS virus has evolved to hide in our genome in a place where it's not going to interrupt anything. And if you take some snippets of the genetic material from the virus and you put them kind of on either side of the gene that you want to deliver, it delivers it to this place. But that's just one place. It's not anywhere you want. The magic of CRISPR is it's literally like a word processor for genomes. You can tell exactly where in the genome you want it to go, and you can trick the repair system into making either an insertion, so you can put more DNA in, you can have it delete something, or you could just change the letters. And there are lots of diseases that we know. There's something like 6,000 known genetic diseases that we know the genetics of. So we know what a healthy gene looks like. And if we just change one letter in some cases back to what most people have, potentially it's a cure. So that's what makes it really attractive. At GenSpace, we were the first to start actually teaching a class to the general public where they were using CRISPR hands-on. And what we did was we thought long and hard about it. We put a hefty dose of kind of contextualizing it into the class through sort of societal ramifications and what it was all about and, you know, the ethical and social and moral things that it raises. We also chose to reiterate a classic George Church experiment with yeast, where if you knock out a particular gene in yeast using CRISPR, it turns pink. So you can actually see it. It's just because of an intermediate in this chain of enzymes. Once it's knocked out, it sort of builds up. I use the Lucy in the Chocolate Factory analogy, if anyone is old enough to remember Lucille Ball's show. But so we felt that we were being very responsible because we were teaching people how CRISPR is used day to day in the lab by millions of scientists in a way that isn't human engineering or anything that is particularly scary or unethical.
There's obviously considerable good that CRISPR can have on society. Immeasurable impact on society. But this also comes with the responsibility to use the technology wisely. And we haven't always seen that.
This is a kind of sore spot because on the one hand, you don't want to curtail the freedom of someone to experiment on themselves. We all do. We all say, well, what if I don't drink that second cup of coffee? Am I going to be able to sleep better? That's an experiment. Or, you know, what if I take, you know, something that is from the health food store. And, you know, a lot of times you find something that works for you and that's great. But in this case, when you're messing with the actual source code of your body, it kind of takes it up to a new level.
In November 2018, a Chinese biophysics researcher by the name of Jian Kui He presented to the world that the first genetically edited twins had been born, pseudonymously named Nana and Lulu. He had edited the CCR5 gene, which codes for a protein that HIV-1 uses to get into a cell. The edited embryos, which were placed in the mother, made the twins HIV-resistant. He had reportedly found a couple through the HIV and AIDS organization in China, where the father had HIV and the mother did not. He's experiment was condemned by the community as not following any ethical guidelines and avoiding the process of peer review.
So the entire community condemned the work of the scientist in China who used CRISPR to make these babies AIDS resistant. Because number one, it wasn't that they had anything wrong with them to begin with. It was more of a preventative thing. And we really don't know what the ramifications of that are going to be.
In December of 2019, Jian Kui He and his colleagues pleaded guilty in Shenzhen, China. And Jian Kui He was placed in jail for 3 years and fined the equivalent of approximately $430,000. He was found to have misled doctors and forged ethical review documents. For many scientists, it's still very premature to edit the DNA of early embryos, sperm, and eggs of humans. These germline edits, or those that can get passed down to future generations, may produce unintended consequences.
Biomedical research is something that takes a tremendous amount of effort. It proceeds very slowly, and these things are proceeding very cautiously.
One thinks for certain, and Dr. Jorgensen echoes this in our conversation. One or two bad actors can be the cause of great reputational damage for an entire community. But we have to realize that bad actors can be found anywhere. And the best way to respond to their work is to focus our energies into serving others. We're seeing this now in real time, in France and all around the world. Ellen has joined forces with a new open source initiative alongside Thomas Lendrin and colleagues at Jogl, J-O-G-L. Just One Giant Lab, helping to open source tools for fighting against COVID-19. And the goal of their Open COVID-19 initiative as a program is to collectively develop and open source low-cost tools and methodologies that are safe and easy to use to fight the global COVID pandemic.
This conversation will undoubtedly continue as we as a society figure out the nuances of both who we are and who we wish to become. As I think about Ellen's leadership in creating opportunities for the public to get involved in science, it's clearer than ever before that we need more people in the world like her.
I'd like to thank Dr. Ellen Jorgensen for her time and generous conversation. You can hear her TED Talk online, which we'll link to in the description. You can also find her work at Biotech Without Borders and Anika Biosciences, which we'll provide a link to in the description. I'm grateful for the work of Pascal McGilvery-Gard and Al Houghton at Dubway Studios in New York City, Nahum Smith for his constant technical magic, and music by UK-based composer Dan Phillipson, and additional music tracks by Jacob Album, Gridded, and Vievery. Most of all, we're grateful to you, our listeners, which make this project both possible and meaningful. We want to hear from you, so please let us know what you think, what's working, what's not working, and everything in between. You can reach us at weare@mergingfutures.com. Again, weare@mergingfutures.com. You can also leave us an audio message at the bottom of our website.
And that's it for today. Take care and take it slow. I'm Lee Kuchevsky, and this is Merging Futures.